Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. As we consider an election year with the country's first female presidential candidate from a major party, we continue to contemplate the imprint of gender in American politics. The University of South Dakota hosts a panel discussion Wednesday evening. Here to discuss gender in politics is USD's Sarah Lampert. She's an assistant professor of history and women, gender, and sexuality studies. She's here with me in our studios in Vermilion. Sarah, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Hi, Lori.
And also with us on the phone, we have Emily Wanless. She's assistant professor at Augustana University. Her teaching and research interests include American politics, institutions, and elections. Emily Wanless, welcome to Dakota Midday as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to start with you, Sarah, real quickly, and tell me about the panel discussion and sort of what was the impetus for having this conversation at this time.
So one of the things the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program has been trying to do is have events where we can have conversations with folks on campus and folks in our community about really present social and political questions. And I started thinking about this almost as soon as we knew that Hillary Clinton would be running for the Democratic nomination. And early in the spring, Donald Trump said that Hillary was playing the woman card. And I thought, okay, so we have an argument made that gender matters here, that gender is part of this election. But in that case, it was used to really dismiss critiques of sexism in the electoral politics. And I thought, well, how can we use our faculty and our resources here to think critically about how gender shapes what it means to run for office, how gender shapes the way in which we view candidates for office, what can political scientists tell us about why women are so disproportionately underrepresented in elected office in this country compared to their presence in the population, what can communications studies folks and folks in media tell us about how we cover folks in politics, how we talk about them, the gendered way we talk about women and men running for office and standing in office. And that's in part what we're trying to do on Wednesday.
So I want to get back to that in a few minutes, the gendered way we talk, because that's an interesting an interesting sort of a conversation to have. Emily, give me an idea of what you've been noticing as you sort of watch this particular election unfold.
I think one of the interesting things, at least from a political science perspective, is that we know quite a bit about women running for office and the underrepresentation of women, but we don't know about it at the highest level. And so, I mean, this is obviously a very important position, and we've yet to have a woman run in as a candidate for the major parties with a legitimate shot at winning. And so it'll be interesting to kind of take into consideration what we know about down-ticket races and women running, and couple that with what we know about things like issue ownership for presidential elections. And so does that complicate the traditional issue ownership of certain presidential issues that are dominated by one party or the other?
When you say issue ownership, give me an example and expand on that a little bit. What do you mean when you say that word?
Sure. So issue ownership is the idea that certain political parties quote-unquote, own an issue based on the history of how the parties have handled that issue, or just nature of the times happened to be in office when a major issue unfolded. And so, for example, Republicans are typically considered to own the issue of national security, terrorism. Democrats are typically believed to own the issues of education, social welfare programs, and stuff like that. And so it's interesting to see if a woman, especially one like Hillary Clinton, who has extensive foreign policy experience, can kind of counter those issues that are typically owned by a Republican candidate.
And how is that going so far? We're pretty far into this thing after the first debate.
And I think both the major party candidates have kind of, their experience lends it to flip this issue ownership idea. And I think it's going to come down to largely which candidate is able to kind of focus or shape the issue agenda on the issues. What we call is issue trespassing, where if a Democrat is able to gain traction in a Republican-owned issue or vice versa, typically the candidate who can do that successfully will win.
So let's go back now, Sarah, to what you said about the gendered way we talk and
sure.
elaborate on that as well.
Well, I think that we live in a very gendered world, right, where we look at each other and we present ourselves according to ideas about how men and women should behave. And certain public roles have a strong association with certain ideas about, for example, elected office is associated with a lot of ideas about traditional ideas about masculinity, being strong and being a provider and having a family, right? These are very traditional ideas about what it means to hold elected office and who can hold elected office and how you present yourself. You want to be forceful. You want to really argue for your party's positions. When women started to enter the world of formal politics, they found themselves, and this is early in the 20th century, caught in a gender double bind, right? Where ideas about how women should be, particularly in this case white women, because these were overwhelmingly white women, how white women should be, conflicted with expectations about how you should present yourself when you're holding public office. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes, on the one hand, you want to present yourself as a very strong proponent of your platform, a strong proponent of your ideas, be passionate. And yet, and we saw this really strongly in coverage of Hillary Clinton's speech at the nominating convention, we saw this in coverage of the debates, the presidential debates, when women are very passionate and argue and are emphatic in their positions, that's often constructed as yelling or being angry. Hillary should smile more, right? Reflects a gender double bind, where on the one hand, you know, smile, we wouldn't ask a male candidate to smile more or see someone being incredibly emphatic about their beliefs to be invalid as a candidate for office, to be angry, right? We want our representatives to be passionate, but women often find themselves caught in competing expectations. And I think men also are called upon to perform their fitness for these positions within a very set script. So I don't want to suggest that this only affects women. We live in this gendered world, right? Mm-hmm. But it often traps women in a double bind that we can see very visibly in how we talk about public figures, like political candidates.
So Emily, this is the same philosophy that would say Mike Dukakis can't cry or Harry Reid can't go. I mean, he was too effusive with his words. Am I reading this correctly?
Certainly. I think that Sarah said on something that is it's difficult for female candidates in addition to all of that, in that we just don't know. We've had years and years and years of audience testing about what is considered palatable in terms of the way to speak, how to convey emotion, what to wear. I remember when Hillary ran in 2008 and she got lambasted for wearing that yellow pantsuit. And it was something so silly as a pantsuit, but you know, we have had testing upon testing of what tie resonates with voters. We just don't have that with women yet, and so not only is this double bind going along, but there's just an uncertainty in general as to how women candidates should conduct themselves.
Is there research going on about how people respond to a female candidate's hair or pantsuit or skirt or shoes?
I believe so, but that would be something that probably our communications colleagues.
Yes. That would be interesting. Interesting thing to bring up. Emily, are we at a different place in America than other countries are in this conversation, or is this sort of an international uniform conversation at this point?
The United States is actually in a very interesting predicament because despite women being underrepresented, and we are disproportionately underrepresented compared to countries around the world, women that run for office are generally as successful as their male counterparts in achieving office once they decide to run. And that's largely because women are much more self-selecting, which is what accounts, we think, for the underrepresentation of women in politics. It's not that that voters are less likely to support them, it's that women run at a much lower rate than men. And so that's something that's kind of unique to the United States, is that we have this environment that isn't necessarily predisposed to not wanting women in public office, but that women themselves maybe do not feel as qualified, despite being qualified. There's been some very fascinating studies done interviewing eligible, we call it the eligibility pool, or people that we would perceive to come and or people we would perceive to run for office, and we do a lot of survey work with them, and women just really don't feel like they are suitable for politics, despite being suitable or qualified. They're not contacted as much by party leadership to run, and so that kind of confirms maybe their hesitations that they're not qualified. And so there's this interesting dynamic that voters maybe aren't, you know, less likely to vote or less supportive of women candidates, but that women themselves aren't, I don't know, as comfortable in running as men.
Do you see this in your college students, both of you? Do you see this shifting at all, the way they behave from a gender perspective, or is it still very much ingrained? I'm wondering if it's generational, and this is something that will just sort of phase out over the years. Sarah, you want to address that?
That's such an interesting question. I think we tend to, as professors, often experience this question in terms of how our students perceive us when they evaluate us. There's some really interesting research. I just read an article this morning, actually, about the gendered patterns in language used to describe professors on Rate My Professor, and that, you know, male professors are more likely to be called geniuses, and female professors are more likely to be called aggressive or bossy. And so there is a very divergent way that we view authority figures when they're men and when they're women. And a lot of times, I think we're not ourselves aware. I mean, I participate in this culture, right? I'm a member of my own culture, and we're often not aware that we're doing it until we're called out on it. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, that great Saturday Night Live sketch where Tina Fey and Amy Poehler talked about sexism, and Tina Fey played Sarah Palin and talked about being dismissed for her looks, right? And that her appearance was read as evidence of her lack of qualifications for office. And then Amy Poehler talks about Hillary Clinton, from Hillary Clinton's perspective, being dismissed because she's too masculine, or because, you know, she is too aggressive, and she's not appealing in a feminine way. And so that double bind again is illustrated there.
Emily, anything that you notice from your students?
I would like to think that, you know, at Augie we have some pretty decent parity between the two genders, and I'm seeing an increase in men enrolled in education classes and women enrolled in STEM classes, these traditionally kind of stereotyped majors. And so I think that it is in a way generational, mm-hmm. And growing so.
Let's talk for a couple minutes about the debate.
Yeah.
So, Sarah, let's start with you, because I'm wondering specifically what you noticed between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton at the debate that had, from your viewpoint, from your educational background, what you were looking for.
I was really interested in how Hillary Clinton would position herself as an expert. Because of the way that she can sometimes be criticized for over-preparing, mm-hmm. right? Or this idea that she tries too hard. And I was really struck by the way in which she stuck to the points that she wanted to make. She was very clear. She didn't seem to hold back in how she presented her knowledge, and really made it clear that preparing for a debate is a positive thing. And so I see her as really trying hard not to fall into some of the traps of being, we talk about the likability trap with Hillary Clinton, and presenting herself and saying, look, I'm qualified, this is what I know, I'm not going to allow myself to be baited. And then at the very end of the debate, when she brought up the case of Ms. Machado and the way that Donald Trump had talked about her, some people have argued that that was a very strategic trap that she may have set for him, to expose a lot of the very sexist ways that he often talks about women. And I thought that was really interesting, interesting analysis of that debate strategy.
Emily, when you watch the debate and the coverage after the debate, what are you looking for?
Well, I think that debates are interesting in that we all tune into them and we're excited for the horse race and the gap and the potential for gaffes. But ultimately what we know about debates is that they do very little unless they are able to present new information to voters, that most viewers are predisposed to a particular candidate for a certain reason, and largely what they see in a debate just reaffirms that. And so I was looking to see if either candidate was able to kind of present either new information or a new characteristic about themselves as a candidate.
And who was successful
and
in that?
I don't know that.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm curious. Did you see what you wanted to see?
You know, I did, and it's so funny because, you know, we think about, every time I talk to Sarah, I always think, like, gosh, I should think so much more outside of myself, or, you know, that she has such a good perspective on kind of the bigger picture of these gendered lenses that we all live in, and so I was sitting there watching it, and I was like, you know, Hillary is coming off as much less shrill and yelling. You know, I thought she was doing a good job of taking that off of the table, you know, if that makes sense. And so if I was a voter looking to find new information, I thought she presented herself, as well as the answers that she gave, didn't fall into the usual stump speech answer so much. You know, for the same reason, I watched the first 10 minutes of his performance and thought, oh, he's a new candidate as well. I think as we all maybe have kind of come to a consensus that the wheels slowly fell off as the debate went on. But overall, I thought that she did a good job of at least presenting a different side of herself other than the one we see at the campaign rally with maybe just really bad acoustics and microphones.
Gender and politics, what does the 2016 election tell us? Will be presented as a panel conversation presented by USD at the Al Newhart Media Center this Wednesday, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Sarah, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Emily, thanks for being here as well.
Yes, thank you so much.